Thank you for joining us for the Dev Team. We're your hosts, Mark Onsman,
Jake Overall,
and Ryan Coates.
We're a group of developers and instructors here to discuss the world of software development. So whether you're brand new or an experienced developer, we're here to chat on topics that affect our lives each and every day. This week on the Dev Team, I will start by talking about BDD and TDD in Word of the Day. Then Jake brings us the news from Hawaii with the latest Microsoft MAUI and Google Workspaces. Finally, I think Ryan might need a nap, or at least he wants to talk about REST. All right. Well, all dad jokes aside, I wanted to talk first in Word of the Day about a couple of testing and behavioral-driven development, or TDD, test-driven development, and behavioral-driven development. Is that something you guys are familiar with? Jake's kind of giving me a look.
Yeah, no, I mean, familiar for sure. Far from expert, I would say. So tell me, Mark, what is the difference between BDD and TDD?
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you asked. First off, so test-driven development, TDD, is this philosophy or this methodology in which essentially every piece of software is first, you write your tests first to the point until the tests fail, then you write the code to solve and pass that test, and then you basically refactor the tests and write more tests, or kind of this, you end up in this loop of red-green refactor. Tests are failing, tests are passing, and you refactor to basically make them work again. So that's test-driven development. On the flip side of that, we have behavioral-driven development, and which behavior-driven development is really kind of this idea of we think of what the user should be able to do and then write our code based on that specific criteria. So when you're writing a behavior-driven development, you might start with some specific task that includes, you know, a title of whatever it is, user can log in, and then maybe a narrative, that kind of that user story of as a I want, so that kind of situation. And then what is the specific acceptance criteria is another way to do that, where you'd be given this when that trigger occurs, then perform this action.
Yeah. So with the nuances of like TDD versus BDD, and, you know, there's people that will argue for days about which is better and which one you should be doing, right? And there's always that word of you should do this or always do this, right? Never do that. And I think you will find all sorts of blog articles that are titled that way, right? With specifically, you know, TDD, BDD, you still have unit tests, right? You still are using your testing suite, right? Your test framework. And it really doesn't come into play too much there, though, or does it?
Well, it kind of depends on specifically what you're testing. And it comes down to, you know, what you're testing and how you're testing it, okay? So what you're testing with behavior-driven development is more of the application behavior from the user's end standpoint. Does it do this thing in a way that I suspect? Whereas TDD is more specifically focusing on functionality and isolation, kind of what we're more used to, probably as developers, because test-driven development is more in the developer side of the house. Behavior development, or BDD, behavior-driven development, really involves the whole dev team. This is your product owner. This is your, you know, Scrum Master, all that kind of, the whole team, in the sense that you are all making these decisions on what the kind of those user stories and things like that. And then when it comes down to how you test it, there aren't both frameworks for both, but with BDD, a lot of times it's kind of a high level, broad topic. It's more of a, what we call black box testing.
Sure. Would you almost say that it encompasses things like end-to-end testing then?
Correct. Yeah. That would definitely be tied. And then, of course, TDD being that white box testing where they can actually interact with the unit tests.
Yeah, no, I think we kind of focus on BDD and TDD quite a lot of work as well. Obviously, there are a lot of other DDs, you know, like functional driven development, acceptance criteria driven development, all that kind of stuff. BDD I find much more useful when I have a kind of business focused team, right? It's much easier for them to, you know, we don't have dedicated testers for the most part, like a lot of orgs might have. We definitely follow the kind of more agile DevOps approach where you write the code, you write the tests. But it definitely gives our product owners and our you know, business analysts and stuff an ability to kind of take a look from the outside in. Now, again, like Jake said, it doesn't mean you don't write unit tests as a developer. You still need to test your code. It just means you're not following the TDD methodology. I did have a couple of my engineers early on think they had to do both. Felt bad for them because that's a lot of work. You know, even with TDD, there's a lot of cases where you may end up with, you know, 2 to 3 times as many lines of code in tests versus the actual code. And sometimes that's valuable for parts of a system. It's not necessarily valuable for all the system, especially when you're trying to get, oh, my code coverage is only at 70%. I'm like, well, how much of that is boilerplate code versus, you know, business logic and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a good thing to specifically bring up, right? Like the 80-20 rule. And, you know, talking about the different, you know, we've domains, right? Or the DDs, right? We've had domain-driven design as well. And so there's a lot of different things that come into play there. And I think when it comes down to testing from a developer standpoint, a lot of times we are more focused on that unit testing, you know, does this critical part of this application always do what it's supposed to do? And, you know, that's kind of the side of the house that, you know, I have a lot more familiarity with, you know, and making sure that, yes, our units are solid. And I think a lot of times when it comes to, you know, the behavior-driven design, things of that nature is yes, it's more of the org is involved, right? More of the team is involved, and not specifically the developer who wrote the service, right? Or the developers that wrote that very specific piece of logic.
Yeah, and kind of build on that and talk about the 80-20 specifically. And when and this is my assumption when you say 80-20 that, you know, 20% of your code is used 80% of the time, right? Most, the majority of your code, your code base is, the 20% of it is handling the core of the function, and you kind of end up with a lot of side stuff.
I tend to think of the 80-20 rule more on the, if you're only going to be able to cover, and talking about code coverage, right? If you're only going to be able to cover 80% of your application, right? There's 20% that's uncovered, right? Make that 20% that's uncovered, you know, the boilerplate stuff, right? Don't bother testing the things that, you know, Microsoft themselves have tests around. Like if you're using like the .NET suite, like you don't need to test, are your controllers loading? Yes, they are. The entire framework is built specifically around that, right? But you should be testing your service logic. You should be testing your business logic. And so that's where I kind of more look at that 80-20 rule of you test what is truly important. And, you know, it's very difficult to maintain 100% code coverage in every single project that you manage, right? And so that's kind of where I would more lean.
Yeah, I think, like I said, you know, code coverage as a metric is not, I don't find it particularly useful, and I don't generally encourage it. If you start setting targets of like, you know, code must have 80% of coverage, it's very easy for devs to go, okay, I can make that happen. Doesn't necessarily mean they're writing good tests or useful tests. So we tend to look at it more from a perspective of, is your code coverage improving over time? Like if I see a PR when I'm doing a code review and you've added, you know, 50 new methods or whatever, and your code coverage has gone down, you know, to 10%, and that's a signal to me that you've added no new tests potentially whilst adding a ton of new logic, right? That's not ideal. Whereas if your code coverage is around the same and you've added one new method, I'm like, okay, well, you're probably still missing a beat, but it's not as concerning to me, right? And that's kind of what we look at. We look for more of that trend over time to you know, indicate whether or not you're following good behaviors or not.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I'd add to that is, you know, again, like you mentioned, having valuable code coverage, right? There's, you could certainly hit every line of code by just running a test that this is a function, or it does not throw an error when I do it the way it's expected to do. And while those can be valuable in some sense, that's not truly what you want with that code coverage. You're going to test that like, hey, let's make sure it does the expected functionality, not just that it exists and doesn't break under normal use.
Yeah. And, you know, there's plenty of good automated tools out there. Talking about doing like code reviews and things of that nature, you know, it's very important that when you are sitting down to do a code review, if someone is writing a test like, yes, this is a function, and yes, this passes appropriate parameters arguments, right? Like, that's not super useful, but absolutely you can hit your code coverage that way. There's a service out there, it's called Code Climate, and it actually will give you a grading on how well your code is written, right? And it falls into things like static code analysis and, you know, different methodologies around how you write your code, if you're writing good, clean code, if you're repeating yourself. And so you have a lot of those metrics that can be tested in a more automated sense. And then that way, during your code review, you actually have time to, you know, really look at the code itself as a whole to say, is this written in a way that we actually approve of as an org, right? And not so much of, does the code do what it's supposed to do, right? I assume if you're a developer and you're on my team, you can make the code do what it's supposed to do, but are you doing it in accordance to the way that we want it done?
I think that's a big identifier there with ending, kind of capping this off here with the TDD, BDD, is behavior-driven development is really that, here's my expectation. I don't necessarily care how it achieves these goals, just input-output type of situation. Whereas obviously with more test-driven development, you can write those specific, here's more specific metrics that I expect. Whereas one is like the user can log in and successfully do so. Whereas the other one is, hey, here are the credentials to test against, like things like brute force attacks and things like that that tie more into the code itself. But that'll wrap up my section for you. I'll kick it over to Jake.
All right. So let's dive into, you know, with the little intro here, the news from Hawaii, right?
Yeah, aloha.
Yeah, aloha. not actually in Hawaii, unfortunately. That would be great. But Microsoft's new UI framework, which is, it looks to be the thing that's probably going to be replacing the Xamarin. And so I think Microsoft kind of redoes this UI layer every couple of years, but they now call it MAUI. And the thing that's really cool about it is the components are specifically designed to write once and build them essentially into any platform, whether it's a mobile app, whether it's a native web app, if it launches for the web or if it launches for a desktop. And so MAUI is really, you know, it's got a little UI builder. It's very similar to kind of the workflow of what Xamarin, you know, users would be familiar with. So go ahead and build out these components, and they are componentized. And I think they build out actually into web components. So you don't even have to be tied into a specific like JavaScript framework if you want to use them on the web. It's, you know, a lot of it just boils down to native JavaScript. So you can plug it into any of your, you know, flavor of the week JavaScript frameworks, whether that's Vue, React, Angular, whatnot. So really pretty cool stuff. And so with that, and I don't know how much multi-platform you guys have to support kind of on the back end side of things, but it allows teams that flexibility of, you know, not having to redo the UI layer, which so many of us love, right, as developers, over and over and over again. And so that's where it really comes to a lot of time-saving things.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the key kind of tenets we have these days is, you know, most of my customers are other developers, right? So one of our key tenets is meeting the developer where they're at. And having frameworks like this in place allows my developers to build something once. And if my customers are coming in on mobile or on a tablet or on a Mac or on a Windows PC or on a Linux box, I don't have to reinvent that 30 times. I mean, I don't know if you guys remember the old IE days where I had to write for every different browser and put a bunch of hooks in and, you know, okay, if it's IE7, do this. If it's IE8, do this. Right? And we all know how fun that was.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's something that I still face even today, regardless of the fact that, you know, we have like Babel and, you know, just the, quite frankly, the JavaScript world, the web world is still a mess, right? The wild, wild west is what WWW actually stands for, I'm convinced. But you know, even now, just the other day, I was, you know, supporting one of our web apps and it broke in Firefox because of a random change that Firefox did. And it's just like, seriously, come on, right? And so that is where, yeah, it's really nice. And as we're starting to see kind of CSS progress, a lot of these frameworks and tooling are actually, and MAUI specifically, kind of has a CSS-like code style for actually building out those components. So it's kind of helping to bridge that gap between, you know, your web developers and your native developers.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I haven't had to deal with it as much as maybe the older members of the team have.
How rude.
Mm-hmm. But that's
I'm going to remember that one.
I can definitely see, you know, obviously kind of played around a bit more with Xamarin and stuff coming, the kind of the precursor to all this. And I think that there's definitely a good amount of flexibility that builds in. And ultimately, we always know that, you know, there's no such thing as any dev team can't just hire like one full stack person that handles every single thing. And even though there's tools such as this that exist, you still need to have specialties into that. So do you see that that's still coming into play here? You know, I'm going to have somebody specifically, this is my Swift developer, this is my, you know, whatever it might be, Android developers and things like that, that tie into more specific kind of roles? Or do you think that something like this could eventually build into that? Like, hey, it doesn't really matter.
I mean, I think that's a multifaceted question to be for sure, right? Like expecting to be able to hire one person that can, you know, quote unquote, work across the full stack, right? Inevitably, that person's going to be, you know, mediocre at most, right? And so I think, yeah, on any particular team, you're going to have those people that, you know, specialize and, you know, specifically are good at what they do, whether that's server-side logic, client-side logic, middleware logic, you know, that is definitely a skill that a lot of people take years to truly build into and kind of find their niche, right? And so if you've always been a good UI person, you're probably going to be just fine, you know, picking up something like MAUI, right? But if you are traditionally that back-end, you know, SQL Management Studio developer, MAUI's not going to be any easier for you than CSS was, right? Like, it's still going to be that difficult presentation layer. And I don't think very many people are really, truly good at all of the different tiers all at once.
Well, and I think some of the excitement around frameworks like this, kind of like the kind of rumblings we got when React Native came around and some of the new WinUI developments, it's really about, can we get back to native code per platform, right? Because I think we've all had fun times with Electron and all that it has done for us. You know, there are great examples of Electron apps like Visual Studio Code. But then you've got Slack. It's a chat client, and somehow it's taking up 4 gigs of memory on my laptop, and it's like...
Yeah, I don't think anybody from the Slack team listens to this podcast, but if you do, you need to solve that problem.
Stop.
Well, and it's not the only example. I mean, you know, Electron has a lot of power to it in that I can write once and deploy anywhere, but there's a lot of disadvantages to not using kind of native code as well. It's just a browser, right? Like, and it's just running, and it gives you that. It's funny because we talked about cores last week, and some of these tools, because they're just browsers, they introduce that problem, even though you wouldn't normally expect them from the type of application that you're dealing with. So no, I think these kind of frameworks are definitely exciting in that regard. If they can help people kind of get that kind of application build process down, and you know, being able to go back to native code and put it on an iPhone or an Android or, you know, or a Windows box, I think there's definitely some value there if it's done right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the real power of something like MAUI. And, you know, specifically, it's a UI tool built specifically and maintained by Microsoft. And so when you build it in, you know, it's essentially a C# backing language. So you build it in that, and it boils down and compiles out to whatever your target platform is, like many of the other workflows we've started to see. I mean, I think it's not fully supported yet, but it's even like, hey, if you want to build this thing out for the Nintendo Switch, right, we'll just target that specific system and bam, your UI is going to look the same.
Well, cool. You kind of mentioned, and Ryan was talking about IDEs and kind of working together and collaborating. Jake, you had some other updates for us from Google.
Yeah. So I don't know if you guys have used the G Suite or Google Apps for Business, I think is what it was originally called. And then they kind of rebranded to G Suite. Well, Google is doing what they do best in keeping all the same tools, but rebranding under a different name. And so that is now being called Google Workspace. And the thing that is exciting about it is a lot of the features that used to be paid, such as, throwing like the Gmail behind your own custom domain, all of that's actually now opening up to be free to all of your Google users, right? And so the other kind of cool stuff that's coming along with Google Workspace and just getting advantage of kind of the business suite, I've used that for a long time here with CodeWorks, is all of the collaboration between the Google tools is now getting a large UI overhaul as well, right? Talking about UI again, but now all of their tools, Gmail, Calendar, Jamboard, all of those things they're all seamlessly integrated into kind of one overarching app now. And so if you want to say, hey, take this email that just came in and add that to my calendar, you can now open the calendar directly within the Gmail client. It opens kind of on the right bar. And so it's pretty neat. I don't know if Google's actually taking advantage of the new HTML portals. I think portals in and of themselves are still kind of experimental. And I think they're actually behind a feature flag right at the moment. But kind of the UI and the way that this is working, it looks to me like Google has to be playing around with the new HTML portals in order to be pulling it off exactly how it is. And again, this is one of those things that, I mean, it's just like breaking news just happened today that Google announced this change. But I think we're going to be seeing quite a bit of updates to the to your traditional Google suite of apps here in the next couple of weeks.
I think you're kind of seeing traditionally what Google does, and that is kind of try and take other apps that people have been successful at and essentially integrate and rebuild and things like that. I know they're trying to, and they've done video calls for a while, haven't tried out Google's Meet, Have you at all? I remember a while ago, previous Google Apps, when they had kind of video calls and they were just kind of meh. But I've heard good things so far about Meet, which is kind of a rebranding of some of their older tools.
Yeah, Meet is kind of a rebranding of Hangouts.
Hangouts,
and there was Duo. And, you know, yeah, there's been quite a bit. And of course, I think they're just rebranding it to just chat now, right? And chat can be text chat or video chat. It can include rooms and things of that nature as well. And, you know, when COVID first hit last year and we had to make this quick shift into, you know, pushing everyone remote, it was, let's test out a bunch of different, you know, video sharing platforms. And, you know, not to talk ill of Zoom, because, you know, Zoom has largely kind of filled in the gap where we needed it in particular. It wasn't necessarily the best integration. It wasn't the best or smoothest kind of change. And ultimately, yeah, we all survived and it was good, but it is interesting to see kind of what these different video service platforms have learned from the experience of, you know, so many people being pushed remote so quickly to kind of see some of the updates that are coming out on these different chat platforms. It's just kind of interesting. I think it's something that is still definitely under development.
Well, I'm sure you guys maybe face this from more of a large organization, enterprise level, with Zoom obviously had some security concerns, and obviously Google being a little bit more trusted platform, maybe. thoughts on that are maybe I'll
keep trusted those. If you just want to sell all your information away, right?
Yep. I'll keep that, the rest of that, to myself. But what are your thoughts there, Ryan?
No, I mean, I'd be honest, if you hadn't have listed all those actual product names, Jake, you, it sounded like you were talking about Microsoft to me, because we've gone through the same thing with Live Server and Office Server and, you know, Skype for Business, Teams. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. We unfortunately support multiple kind of chat and video platforms at work, just, you know, because of the size of our organization and how obviously long it takes to weed things out. So some of that integration is challenging when, you know, I'm sending a Teams meeting to someone, or they're sending me a Zoom meeting or a Skype meeting, and it's just like, oh, I'm not logged onto Skype anymore, and Teams doesn't tell you that, so you don't send me. It's been difficult, but I think recently at Build, Microsoft had similar announcements to improvements to Teams and some of the capabilities there, and I think you're right. You know, the stuff people have learned over the last year is fairly significant. I don't think anybody was really prepared for it, and I'm kind of grateful to all the kind of orgs who moved very quickly to solve problems. You know, Zoom is an example. You know, we did have some early concerns that kind of came up, but they put a lot of that to rest very quickly. And again, as an enterprise customer, we have access to a lot of the features that, you know, we're already there, but maybe not exposed to, you know, the free version and stuff like that. So we've kind of gone all in on Zoom and Teams at the moment. And, you know, again, I don't know if that'll go one way or the other for us. Again, pros and cons, but we're a big org. So yeah.
I think any software really that you get that helps collaborate. And that's one thing that Google's done well, even from, you know, Google Docs and Sheets and even more of those simpler applications, is they're very easy to collaborate on. And I think that kind of looking over kind of the announcement that they had for it, they're really working to see what they can do to integrate more those apps together with the things like Meet or with, you know, video conferencing or just the kind of sharing of stuff across a page, even project management and things like that.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that is one thing that is really nice is, I don't know if we just call it shameless stealing these days, but I feel like Microsoft with the Office suite has learned a lot from, you know, things like Google Docs and its first iterations, and it's integrated a lot of that, you know, live sharing and things of that nature. And, you know, the Microsoft Word platform has always been wonderful for document editing. And I just was recently using the Office 365 Word, and, you know, it's got all the same capabilities as Google Docs, right? And so I think a lot of these different larger orgs and services, service platforms, right? These big companies, again, shamelessly stealing ideas from one another, but they're all building up for what ultimately is a better user experience. And that is something that I will never complain against.
Well, and I think from a business perspective too, I think, you know, they say if a product is successful, then, you know, there's a market for it. So if I'm going to build a tool, I have the risk of building something completely net new that nobody's heard of before. And, you know, I could be a unicorn. I could sell that for a lot of money. But there's an awful lot more market for things that might already be there, but you can do slightly better. Right. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, take Slack is a perfect example of that. I mean, we just brought it up, right? But I mean, I've been using instant messengers for years, right? Like, let's go back to AOL, instant messenger, AIM or whatever, right?
And there's a lot of shame in those chat rooms, I think.
You know, it's back
more,
to the
more
early,
an ICQ guy myself.
Yeah, ICQ or, you know, IRC, all of those multi-chat platforms, right? And so, yeah, you take something like Slack, which I feel like when it first came out, it was very targeted at, you know, tech companies. And it was a chat platform specifically for tech companies. And, you know, again, do one thing, do it well, and look at the success that they've had.
All right. You see the same thing with Discord for gamers, just kind of across the board.
Yep, absolutely. So that'll kind of wrap it up for me. Ryan, I think we're ready to take a nap, right?
I am. It's been a long day. Yeah, so you know, maybe I'm being a little self-serving here by going for REST, but I just had to put an API standards class together for work. And you know, one of the things that comes up a lot is, you know, REST is part of our standard, and a lot of folks, they just, you know, they go off and build an HTTP API. Here we go, we've met the standard, and you know, it's not necessarily the case. And I think there's a lot of confusion between what REST actually is, what it means, and some of the capabilities and things that it can expose if done right, versus just a typical HTTP API, of which, you know, I think the rule is all REST APIs are HTTP APIs, but not all HTTP APIs are REST APIs, right? So what do you guys see? You know, obviously you guys do a lot of training, a lot of teaching. You know, what do you introduce to students, and how far along that kind of journey do they go?
One of the biggest things I think we initially focus on is kind of that idea of stateless, right? And of course, REST, our acronym for representational state transfer. And the biggest thing we kind of initially start focusing on is stateless, right? We, as a part of our course, we start with kind of those client-side apps, and we create a state and all that kind of stuff, and they're calling to other APIs for just data. And so they're used to that state in the client. But then we switch over to the server, and it's like, no, they'll keep any of that data, all of it, and maybe gets pushed to a database, but there's no actual, every request, again, being that unique one. I think that that's probably the biggest focus I try and make for it, is that, again, your server has to basically start up and do whatever it is, the request you need out of the box. You don't have to go through, here's the six processes you need to set up that one request.
Yeah, I think something else to definitely focus on with the concepts of, you know, trying to build a RESTful API, right, is making sure that you understand the different HTTP methods, right, the HTTP verbs. You know, that's where we get post, put, delete, right, to specific resources, things of that nature, and how that follows, like, the CRUD methodologies. And so that is, you know, one of those things that we focus on, but, you know, not every single API out there, like you were saying, is necessarily a, or should be a RESTful API. And sometimes, yeah, they're not even HTTP, right? And so if we're talking specifically about APIs across HTTP, right, then yeah, there's the RESTful standards that we try to adhere to, right? And I think the actual spec behind REST is, you know, every single request should come back with URLs where you can then get more information. And so it's definitely one of those things where we build it in kind of a more simplified manner. You know, if you're going to request or want to create data, we focus primarily on just the kind of the higher level workings of an API, something that you're managing yourself, typically behind like a node server.
Yeah, no, it's interesting you talk about that, because so there's a model that's kind of been applied towards REST, the what is it, the Richardson maturity model, and it talks about and what you just described, actually giving back links and you know, that representation back in a request or response. You know, that's very much a level three maturity model, and you know, level one is obviously just using resources and part of your paths and stuff like that. Level two is actually using the appropriate verbs and methods and stuff like that. And you know, I think there's definitely value to be able to, you know, if your application can understand and make decisions based on the request it's got back. I've got this response. It has four links for delete, update. Oh, cool. So I'll just flash up two new buttons on the website and call it good. I do think it's important to kind of understand, you know, things like stateless and stuff like that. We for the most part have, you know, fairly standardized on things like REST. We do a lot of infrastructure APIs, and ideally we want them to do the same thing again and again and again without, you know, a ton of setup or state management. But at the same time, we also have a lot of orchestration APIs that build on top of those, and it doesn't necessarily make sense for those to not be stateless, right? So some of those orchestration APIs, they're long running, they're calling a bunch of different backend systems to do things, and they need to obviously be aware of each part of that process as they move from step one to step two to step three to actually deliver whatever the user is trying to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of, to me, that's one of those distinguishing factors between, are you building an API for a web client that you expect all of your users to be using? Or are you building an API that, sure, it's going to communicate over HTTP, maybe between two servers, that's totally fine. But if I have server-to-server communication, now I can, you know, with a little bit more safety, build things out in such a way where we can have a little bit of state management going on between servers. But, you know, when you're building a web client and you don't know who's randomly pinging that server, 99% of the time, not using your application, using tools like Postman or just straight up curl from the terminal, right? Like, there's security concerns that you want to kind of keep in mind, right? And so that's where I say, you know, the build the right platform, build the right tool for the right job, right? And so for me, a web client API is pretty dumb, right? It's pretty dumb. And it pretty much is only responsible for get, post, put, delete, creating data, updating data, you know, deleting that data, you know. And so that is kind of one of those things that, you know, you think about and you say, okay, well, here's my identity is probably managed by some other service, some sort of tokenized provider, you know, some sort of other layer, whether that's Active Directory or whatnot, you know. And pretty much what we do from there is you have access to your own content, but very rarely do I give you access to anything other than what you have yourself created, if that kind of makes sense.
And I think kind of one of the other things, and you touched on this a couple of times, kind of a guiding principle of REST is a layered system. And we see that obviously in the way we design it as well, as we kind of have these, you have your controllers, of course, being registered, and those are kind of your dumb, here's our endpoint. It doesn't really have any business logic there. We create then our service layer, or essentially our business logic layer, where again, it's handling all that kind of more here specific to this API decisions. And then of course you have kind of your data layer, and these are into your applications. So there could be way more layers than that, of course, but just kind of in that simplified version, again, especially starting out, separating the concerns of, hey, here's kind of the functional endpoints, then we move into here's the code logic specifically of what can and can't be done. And then beneath that, that layer may have to access specific data. Your data layer also being dumb, just saying, hey, I'll get whatever the service layer needs. And I think that that also really helps kind of code organization, and it creates kind of a predictability, I think, is one of the biggest things I would push towards it. And even talking about before the resource patterns, right, where you have collection ID, kind of that consistency allows you to have a much more user-friendly API.
Right. And so like one of the things, and this would be completely new to any of our students at this current point in time, but there's some processes that say, hey, I want to create, well, maybe let's stand up an entire server, or let's stand up an entire database. That's not going to happen in a simple HTTP request, right? That's going to be one of those things where I, you know, using my auth token or whatever, I make a request to go stand something up. And what I get back is information about the links of where I can get the progress on, is this thing done yet? When this is done, here's where I'm going to go, right? And so that is that's a completely different concept as well when talking about being RESTful, right? And that's where you go back to, if as a web client, I can make a request for something to be done, but I don't know when that necessarily is going to be done. And I would not have my web clients talking to my service bus directly, right? Like I go into some sort of specific web API, that API through a machine token has permission to make requests to kind of the service layer or the service bus.
No, that's actually a great kind of example of what we do. We will make requests for long-running tasks such as creating cloud resources. And so we'll make that call and you'll get back a status link. And so you can follow that status link, and maybe that for the moment is just going to tell you, it's pending, it's pending. Once it's complete, that might give you a ton of extra links. Like, okay, here's the connection string. Here's how to log in. Here's the management interface. Here's how to update the password or the firewall rules or whatever, right? There's a lot of value that from a discovery perspective for the user, even if they are using Postman or curl, they're going to get some information back that gives them an idea of what the next steps are. But if you have an intelligent UI built on front of that, that can actually, you know, think like a CLI tool or a website. I mean, if you go and click create cloud resources today, they kind of work in the same way. You get a little bubble. Okay, it's working. It's pending. And when it's finished, it's, hey, go to your resource. Or, hey, you know, access it, connect to it, that kind of thing, right? And it's kind of how we represent that at the API layer as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if you do have your web client, there's many ways of managing that, right? A lot of times it's, I'm going to make an HTTP request, right? And we'll call it a post request if we're going to try to create or stand something up, right? And what that may actually be doing is say, okay, well, when I make this post request, let's also establish the socket connection. And then the server on its own time frame can ping me back kind of status updates and, you know, our long polling requests, things of that nature. There's a lot of different ways of managing truly what is a restful client.
All righty. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up there, and we'll call it a day for this episode too. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
That's a wrap for the dev team. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to subscribe to our channel for the latest content anywhere great podcasts are found. And remember, if you want Kincode,
wash your hands.